Welcome back to part two of our robotics show. The questions around robotics are so numerous that we will have to be coming back probably several times to this topic. But in today's follow-on, Dr. James Hilder of the University of York takes the discussion into some very important areas. We speak about how robots process the spoken word and how difficult that is, how they can help security, and also how they can be vulnerable at times to security issues. We talk about the amazing things like swarm robots, and finally about introductory software and languages. Both Olivia and I feel, and James has demonstrated the fact very clearly, that this two-part episode is just a taster, and we'll certainly be coming back to the topic as soon as we can. In the meantime, let's hear some more from Dr. James Hilder of the Institute for Safe Autonomy. The idea of integrating artificial intelligence with robots is something I know that everybody is a bit worried about. And you, I think, grazed on it there when you said that people get creeped out by robots that look too much like a human being. And presumably, is that partially a fear that the robots would be a threat?
I think it probably is, yeah. I think there is something really just deeply unnerving about talking to something we know as a machine and yet is you know, effectively almost pretending to be a human. I think it's much the same as when, you know, you get calls from a robot. You get spam
voice.
Calls from the voice, but it's got a human voice, and it's that short period of realization that you're not talking to a human but you're talking to a robot that is unnerving. I think there's a lot of research goes on into human computer or human robot interaction and how we can perhaps both make it better but also get rid of some of this unnerving side of
the fear part of it. It's a bit early in the robot development for you to be doing this, but do you see in the future link ups between departments such as yourselves, the Institute of Safe Autonomy, and the psychology departments?
Very much. What the Institute for Safe Autonomy is almost a hub of different research groups at the university. So we have, I think at the core, we've got a lot of computer scientists, and there particularly we've got the Assuring Autonomy International Programme. So the computer scientists at York who are working in robotics, they're particularly interested in how do we basically make computer programs for robots that are safe, which is it's a problem that's obvious, but it's actually, you know, it's quite new that there hasn't been much in the way of things like legislation about how do we both make a robot safe and what happens when something goes wrong with a robot.
Of course.
So, you know, it's who's liable? Is it the person who wrote the computer program? Is it the person who built the robot? Or is it the owner of the robot, the operator of the robot? So there's an awful lot of work there. But then we also have various other groups at the university working in the building, including psychologists. We've got a lot of people from, we've got ethicists, so dealing with the ethics of robots and human interaction. And then we've got groups who are also looking at some more sort of out there things, such as quantum communication. So one of the issues we see in the future certainly is that communication channels. So obviously robots are very reliant now on the internet, on being able to talk to other robots or being able to talk to cloud services. Obviously, we're well aware that computer systems can be hacked, that they're not inherently secure. And so this still applies to robots as well, and perhaps even more so in the future.
Yeah.
And so we've got groups looking at interesting ways of how can we create more secure communication channels between robots and the internet, or robots and other robots, things like that.
And is that quantum communication that you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah. So that's using basically looking at quantum.
Wow. So. Well, in terms of those risks then, like the cyber risks, especially in terms of actually people hacking these robots, what happens when we get closer and closer to autonomous systems to the point where they are fully autonomous? Is there ever going to be a risk where these robots just ignore their human commands? Or do you think there's going to be any sort of issues with robots taking over kind of vibe?
I mean, it's the million-dollar question. And I personally think, yeah, there is risks. There's huge risks but there's risks in any computer system. I don't know about this idea of sort of robots becoming self-aware and taking over the world. I don't think we're in a Terminator situation. But more realistically, things that you could see happening, foresee happening. I mean, one really obvious thing that occurs to me is say, for example, the GPS system is targeted, is hacked somehow, and that goes down. And I don't think that's a completely unrealistic idea. That would have a huge impact on all sorts of autonomous systems and not autonomous systems as well, because we're really heavily reliant on things like GPS, particularly, you know, self-driving cars.
Yeah.
They're pretty much solely reliant on that to work out where they are and to work out where they're going. So that's a big point of failure. So there's an awful lot of work that goes on into trying to either minimize single points of failure or add resilience and robustness by either having multiple things like that in parallel. So for one example, now we're not just reliant on GPS, we have GLONASS and Galileo as two alternative positioning systems. So there are basically three systems that can all tell us where we are in the world, and most of the modern devices that do positioning will have all three of those networks built into them. So there's a bit of resilience there, but still not fault-proof. Likewise, we've seen that internet systems can go down. Obviously, earlier this year, Facebook went down, didn't it?
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's beyond the stretch of reason to also think that anything similar to that could go down. Amazon Web Services could go down. Google could go down. And we perhaps, it's easy to be to lose sight of how much reliance some things like robotic systems might have on these cloud provisions, these cloud internet provisions. Some of the things we try and do on robots, particularly on smaller robots, are really challenging. So even something like speech recognition. So basically listening to me, working out what I'm saying. I know we're all very used these days to things like Alexas and Siri. And that working reasonably well. we can speak to Alexa and ask it a question, and we can ask the question in different ways, and it's got natural language processing built in there, and it usually responds, you know, it can usually understand what we're saying as long as the environment's okay and not too much background noise. But the way it's doing that is it's sampling the recording of what we say and sending that off to the cloud, to Amazon Web Services, where they have a very well-trained neural network that does the natural language processing running on a very powerful computer. But yeah, of course, the trouble is we're then very reliant on Amazon Web Services. If Amazon Web Services go down, speak to you, it won't do anything. It'll just go off for a bit. The trouble is we're also reliant on this for various robotic systems, perhaps more than we realize.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Alexa thing is a sort of phone a friend, isn't it? When you get into problems, you ask the big guy. But if is there any alternative to the internet, or do you think that somehow quantum computing will help to make it more resilient to these sorts of issues?
That could work either way. I think one of quantum computing potentially opens a whole new sort of a vast new tier of computing capability, in the sense that it would let us do certain tasks much quicker. But the risk in that is that one of the tasks that quantum computing would potentially let us do much quicker is cracking existing security systems. So one of the things that one of the primary things that that's been identified that quantum computing will be able to do is to crack our existing
passwords.
Basic cyber security. So, you know, something that might take a supercomputer months or years to crack a password, the theory is that if you have a quantum computer with enough qubits, it could do it in a matter of seconds. and if that happens, then all our existing security is effectively null and void. Right. Now, it's not a disaster, because then the theory is that you can use quantum computing for your security. But yeah, it's an interesting problem.
Yeah,
definitely.
And that's something that people will have to deal with in the coming years, presumably, as we develop robots. So there's, if I'm right here as a layperson, we're talking about a number of parallel developments. Robots cannot be developed just by themselves. There's all sorts of parallel development to take place. Is that actually what the Institute for Safe Autonomy is really all about, all of these parallel streams?
I think so, yeah. Very much. So the Institute's got, as I was saying, it's got a number of different labs where we're kind of trying to investigate these new areas. We've got this quantum lab. We're also looking at we've got underwater communications. There's another specialist lab there, so we have a deep underwater pool, which is essentially it's like an anechoic chamber but underwater. So we have very expensive tiles on the wall of this tank, and that's used for underwater sonar investigations. And then we're also investigating high altitude communication. So we're going to have a helikite, which is like an airship flying from the roof, and that will be communicating with various points on campus and elsewhere. So we're looking at things there and how we can basically do things such as provide internet, perhaps for hard to reach areas. That's one of the potential uses of this quantum stuff. Of this high access, high altitude lab. And then the rest of the building is largely devoted to robotics labs of various sorts. So we're dealing right from very small robots. We've got some swarm robots research going on, which robots that might be the size of a mug or very small, going up to big outdoor vehicles. And we're right by a lake. So the plan is that ultimately we'll have work going on outside, both on the ground and also multi-terrain across the lake. So all sorts of different research going on in there. But yeah, it's trying to tie together all these different aspects of robotics, but with safety as the core overriding. Yeah.
So what's a swarm robot?
Excuse me. swarm robotics is most of the robotics research we've done historically at York has been what we call biologically inspired. I wouldn't say we're moving away from that. We're now moving perhaps more into the safety realm, but historically we've been very much focused on looking at biology and elements of biology and how that might apply to robotics. And one area that we've done a lot of work in is swarm robotics. So in a nutshell, what we have is generally some very simple robots, really quite, I wouldn't say dumb, but limited in capability. So they may have a very limited range of sensors on them. They probably don't have the sort of things that you'd expect on a modern robot. They can't hear people, they don't have a very powerful processor on them. So they'd be quite simple robots, but they work together to try and solve some task.
Okay.
And usually that's inspired by what we've seen in nature. So we'll have various groups of people. We might have biologists who study animals. So for example, we've worked with people, I can't remember which university it is, so I won't say. We've worked with people. We have worked with people who have studied bees. Okay, they've studied how bee colonies form and how bees move about within bee colony. And then we've applied that to underwater robots. So we've had a swarm of very simple submarines, and we've used the clustering algorithms that we've developed from the bees and applied that to the robots to be able to make these underwater robots cluster together so they don't get lost in the ocean. Another example would be ants. So as ants move about, they lay a pheromone trail. And basically they move, they'll forage to find food, they lay a bit of pheromone, and then they move back. And over time, what happens is the pheromone trail will build up strongest on the most direct path to that food. And so you can then also make a model of this algorithm, and we can do it in simulation, usually is how we start. So we'll have a simulator that will have hundreds or thousands of virtual ants in it, and that will create an algorithm which lets us find the shortest path from A to B, where B is a piece of food. But of course, we can then apply this also to real robots. So we've done a lot of work in the past with small swarms, various sorts of robots. We've built some in-house. Perhaps the simplest swarm robot at the moment or one of the widely used ones is something called a Kilobot, which is a really, really simple robot. It's got essentially three matchstick legs and a vibrating motor that can vibrate in one of two ways.
Okay.
And that essentially makes the robot almost effectively sort of move forward or spin on the spot. And then it's got a single infrared LED on the top, which it can use to infrared LED on the top and an infrared transceiver, I should say, so it can receive and emit infrared light. And that can be used to program it, but also it can be used to detect if other robots are particularly near it. So it's a really, really simple robot. There's very little going on in there, but that's been used to form some really interesting shape-forming algorithms. There's really cool videos on the internet of like 1,000 of these robots in a table, and it can form various shapes, and it's sort of an emergent behavior you see over time.
That's incredible. Yeah.
How will these sets of algorithms you're developing with simple robots be used in the real world, do you think?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of potential applications for swarm robots. One of the big areas where I think they could be really useful is areas where what one might call a traditional robot or a really feature-rich robot might be very expensive if it was lost. So as I was saying before, we had swarms of underwater robots. And yeah, this was partially inspired by things like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill and the Air France jet that got lost in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
So at the moment, what we do when there's a situation like that is we basically send a boat over there, and on the boat there would be a very expensive tethered submarine that might be really big. So an autonomous submarine, and that goes down and will search about the area. There are limitations with that though. One is that obviously this submarine is big and expensive, and another one is because it's so big, it perhaps can't get into spaces that a smaller robot could. So the idea is, if you imagine, rather than deploying over this one huge robot, if you were to just tip a load, a swarm of much smaller robots on the side, over the side, and they then essentially form a chain from the surface down to the search area. And then at the search area, you'd have a cluster of robots that can spread about, divide up the task, so search a wider area, but could also potentially get into areas that the big robot couldn't. So if it's a shipwreck or a plane crash at the bed of the ocean, the smaller robots might be able to get in there and map the area internally. Likewise, if it's something like an oil pipeline, sometimes having smaller robots that can sort of, still relatively simple, but can spread apart and divide up a task, can do things that the larger robot on its own couldn't do. Also, if they're small robots and they're cheap and you lose a load of them, you lose a few of them, loss isn't as much. No, you can almost perhaps not treat them as disposable, but
yeah,
you know, if you treat your fleet of robots as a whole, then you know, you're just losing a small percentage of them, might not be such a big deal.
That's fascinating.
Oh, it's unbelievable. That's great. James, you've obviously got an incredibly fascinating job, but what about it really turns you on personally? How do you, what's exciting for you?
I think the bit of the job, well, I'm an electronic engineer by degree, and the bit of the job that I've always really liked and really sort of got me into the robotics side of thing was it's the mixture of electronics and computer science. So the mixture of writing programs, but not writing programs for a computer, writing programs to interact with hardware, be that sensors or be that actuators. I think I've always just liked being able to control things with a computer and being able to do things beyond just on a screen. So I'm really into designing robots that are sort of accessible. So we've designed robots for teaching, we've designed robots for outreach, for going to schools and things like that. So things that can be like quite a good introduction to robotics. And I think there's nothing better than writing a program that turns on a light or makes music. I just love it. I always have. That's the area that I really like. And it's such a growing area. It's so expanding because we've got so many cheap single board computers, things like Raspberry Pi and Arduino that just weren't available barely 10 years ago now. And now people can go out and buy one of these bits of hardware for as cheap as £5 for a Raspberry Pi Zero that they can write a program on, and that can do things, you know, that can actually do useful things. It can talk to the internet, it can turn things on, it can make motors spin. The limitless application, and yet it's become really affordable and really accessible. Both in terms, you know, the hardware is very affordable, but also the library of software that's been written is vast, and some of it's really easy to use. It's really good introduction to that whole world.
So how would you personally recommend that younger generations get into this world? Would you say it would be to go directly for these Raspberry Pis, or do you think there's another easier route to get people excited?
I wouldn't say that it's absolutely definitely the Raspberry Pi. I think there are a lot of really similar things. So we've got things like the BBC Microbit is brilliant for younger people. I think that's possibly the best for sort of primary age. Arduino is really good. So Arduino, but Microbit and Arduino are based around what we call microcontrollers. So these are relatively simple compute modules that don't run a full operating system, whereas your Raspberry Pi runs a complete operating system. So there's quite a step change in performance and capability in there and what they do. Something like a Microbit's a brilliant introduction. It's very easy to get bits to plug into it and to write code that's getting to work. However, obviously, if you make the step up to something like Raspberry Pi where it's running the full operating system, that then lets you do more sophisticated things. So if you wanted to attach a display to it, or you wanted to get it to interact with the internet, perhaps to use some of these cloud services. So if you wanted to have a robot that could do speech recognition, for example, you're probably better off working from the Raspberry Pi. But they're all really good. The Microbit, the Arduino, all the Raspberry Pi family, and others. There's just so many entry points now. I think perhaps the trickier thing is knowing, you know, what the best one for you is.
Is it age related then? That's a sort of a stairway from Microbits up to Raspberry Pi and then beyond.
I think to an extent it probably is. Just having something like the Microbit or the Arduino where it's very easy to get your Hello World program written on it.
Your own children, will you be encouraging them to take this particular journey?
My eldest has already started going to the local coding club at the library where he's using Microbits, and he's getting really into that. So it's embarrassing, really. I should be more involved, I think, myself. But sometimes I don't think he wants to do it with Dad when there's not as cool. But absolutely. I think and we've always been really keen in sort of promoting outreach and getting robotics into schools and just, you know, letting kids see that this is it's fun. It just is genuinely fun, I think, to do this stuff.
Do kids relate to it very quickly, or is it something that they find hard?
No, I think a lot of them really do. I think a lot of computer games aren't a million miles off
of course,
the sort of programming that's going on. So, you know, kids these days are used to particularly things like Minecraft, I guess, where they're building things up. And actually in a game like Minecraft, there's more than perhaps is obvious from the outside elements of
coding
electronics.
Elements.
You're coding and like basic electronics as building blocks of logic circuits in there. And it's therefore not a huge step to then move from that onto something like Scratch, which is, I think most kids now actually learn to some extent at school, which is a brilliant introductory language for robotics and for autonomous systems. So, you know, you can make things in Scratch, and then from that you can make robots that work with Scratch. And from there, the natural step, I think, is to move on to probably a high-level language, generally Python or possibly C++. But Python, I find pretty accessible, I think, for learning the basics of programming.
James, this has been absolutely fascinating. We've sort of run out of time. Can I just thank you very much for your time?
And
for the insight into how people can get involved in robotics, and for the obvious excitement and enthusiasm that you display for the subject. It's been really great. Thank you. And if we, I think there's about 5 different podcasts in here as usual.
Easily.
We'll probably be coming back to the University of York very, very quickly. But thanks very much indeed for your time, James.
Thank you so much, James.